did not find any means to spend. So this is, of course, a holy crying and weeping.
Mm-hmm.
Financially speaking, they are not able to help the prophet because they do not have any camel, any horse, and that is why they are not able to take part in that war. And that is why they are crying, because they are not able to help the prophet. The next one, which is of course very clear, is to cry for the calamities of the Ahlul Bayt alayhimus salam. There are many narrations in this regard. Allama Majlisi has a chapter in his Bihar al-Anwar titled Thawabul Buka ala Musibateh wa Masa'ib Sa'ir al-A'imma alayhimus salam. The reward of crying over the calamities of Imam al-Husayn alayhi salam, and not only him, the calamities on which befell on other imams of the Ahlul Bayt alayhimus salam. There are so many narrations in this regard.
Yes.
Imam Ridha alayhi salam is quoted as saying, the person who, when he remembers the calamities which befell us and then cries, then he will be with us on the day of judgment. And on that day when many people are crying, these people would be happy. Bihar al-Anwar, volume 44, page 278.
Yes, Dr. Karimi, I'll be back with you after a very short while. Here we need to take a short break. Dear listeners, stay tuned to IRIB English Radio.
I can feel your eyes like the sun shining behind the clouds. I need a morning to shatter this long night forever. I need a hero to stop this thousand-year-old
we're talking about Dua Nutba, and we talked about the kind of tears, kind of crying, kinds of weeping, crying in the light of Quran. Dr. Karimi said it's people cry out of regret for the sins, shedding light through on the verses, explaining it in the light of verses, crying out of enthusiasm, like while recognizing the truth, and crying for being unable to help the truth. Yes, Dr. Karimi.
The next type of cry, which is related to our topic, which is about Imam Mahdi alayhi salam, is to cry because of the occultation of Imam Mahdi alayhi salam.
All right.
And it's been mentioned in some narrations that some people cry because of the ghiba, because of the occultation of Imam Mahdi alayhi salam. There is a very interesting narration in Kamaluddin by Sheikh As-Saduq, volume 2, page 352, in which one of the companions of Imam Sadiq alayhi salam, Sudayr al-Sayrafi, he talks about how Imam Sadiq himself cried because of the difficulties that the Shia go through at the time of the major occultation. And another narration from Imam Ridha alayhi salam, again in the same book, Kamaluddin, volume 2, page 352. In that narration also, Imam Ridha alayhi salam talks about the fact that it would be a very difficult time for the Shia at the time of the major occultation. And Imam admires the people who cry out of grief for the occultation of Imam Mahdi.
Imam, and since we're talking about the crying, since we reached Imam, I get reminded of, if you notice, the viral hit song about Imam Mahdi, sung by the children, and these kids of like 9 years, 10 years, crying for the love of Imam. That's only like it. This crying, I get amazed. Like, what do these kids really understand? How much enthusiastic they are.
And there are so many theories.
And these tears make the elders cry out of the love of Imam.
Yeah. And the last type of cry, which is also approved of, is the emotional one. When we lose our dear ones, it is very, very natural that we cry. Unfortunately, some groups of the Muslims, they are against emotional cry too. The Holy Prophet, when he lost his infant Ibrahim, he began to cry. And some companions, they objected the Prophet. And the Prophet explained that, I mean, this is very natural.
This is normal.
I have lost a dear one. So this is the seventh type of cry which is approved of, but there are some rejected cries, like the cry out of hypocrisy and lie. وَجَاءُوا أَبَاهُمْ عِشَاءً يَبْكُونَ. The brothers of Yusuf, alayhi salam, when they threw him in the well, but at night they came toward their father weeping. So this kind of weeping is a kind of negative one. And the last one is a kind of the one which is not approved, is crying out of humility before the oppressive people. Mm-hmm. And that is why Ibn Ziyad told Zainab salamullahi alayha that, did you see how Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala treated you and your brother? And Lady Zainab salamullahi alayha said, I did not see except beauty. For beauty. So if you cry out of humility before the arrogant people, this is a kind of rejected and disapproved type of crying.
Well, thank you so much, Dr. Karimi, for being with us. Thank you so much for explaining these many kinds of crying, because sometimes we may be right in crying, sometimes we may be wrong.
Exactly.
You shed light through the verses of Holy Book, Holy Quran. Thank you so much for discussing the content so beautifully. Thank you so much, dear listeners, for being with us. In case you want to listen back to this session, you can go back to our official website. That's parstoday.com. Go to the option Call of Islam. You'll find an archive of programs of all the programs of IRIB English Radio. And in case you want to email us your suggestions, you can email us at englishradio@irib.ir. You can also follow us on the social media platforms, searching Call of Islam Radio. Thank you so much for being with us. Stay tuned to IRIB English Radio. Wassalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh.
Midstream. After the issuance of many successive and accelerating indicators in this direction, Hamas announced its decision to return to Syria, ending long years of estrangement with Damascus. Hamas's official statement released on Thursday, September 15, came to culminate a series of meetings that took place between Hamas and the Syrian officials. These meetings included reviews of the previous period and the exchange of notes on the files that must be dealt with seriously, bringing the work now to the stage of confidence building as a prelude to a comprehensive and broad normalization. The rapprochement came after a series of meetings and discussions sponsored by the Lebanese resistance movement Hezbollah. In its statement, Hamas declared its support for Syria in the face of plans aimed at dividing it, stressing its effort to restoring its relations with Damascus. Several talks were launched between Hamas and the Syrian leadership after the Sword of Al-Quds battle under the auspices of the Secretary General of Hezbollah, Sayyid Hassan Nasrallah, as a prelude to restoring the relationship in a larger and broader way. According to sources close to Hamas, this path will accelerate during the coming period in light of the regional and international changes and challenges facing the axis of resistance as a whole and the formation of an alliance of normalization between some Arab countries and the occupation entity under American auspices, which poses a threat to the axis and its parties. Hamas also strongly condemned the repeated Zionist aggression against Syria, especially the recent targeting of the Damascus and Aleppo airports, stressing that Hamas stands by Syria in the face of this aggression. Hamas also expressed its appreciation for the leadership and the people of the Syrian Arab Republic for their role in standing by the Palestinian people and their just cause, while looking forward for Syria to regain its role and position in the Arab and Islamic nations, hoping for sincere efforts for the stability, safety, prosperity, and progress of Syria. This rapprochement is viewed by pro-resistance Arabs as an ending for all manifestations of conflict in the nation and achieving reconciliations and understandings between its components, countries, and forces through serious dialogue in a manner that achieves the interests of the nation and serves its causes, while rejecting and resisting the Zionist project. It is evident that the victory achieved by the resistance in Gaza during the Battle of the Sword of Al-Quds was a gateway to remove any obstacles of dialogue. In light of Hamas's adherence to the principle of non-interference in the internal affairs of Arab countries, while strengthening relations with them in order to gather the energies of the nation to support the Palestinian resistance. Welcome to the Middle East Stream. I'm Marwa Osman. Hamas resolved its political and strategic position by restoring its complete positive vision towards Damascus. In a statement, Hamas affirmed, "The movement will continue to build and develop solid relations with the Syrian Arab Republic, considering that this decision serves the nation and its just causes, with the cause of Palestine at its core." A positive message from Hamas towards Syria, the leadership, and the people in an important political statement at a very sensitive stage. What is the importance of this timing, and how will the resumption of relations between Hamas and Damascus affect the strength of the axis of resistance in West Asia? To discuss this issue with us from the occupied West Bank is Mr. Saleh Abu Azzeh, journalist and political commentator. Thank you for being with us, Mr. Saleh. So 10 years after leaving Syria in the wake of the Western-instigated global war on Syria, while many had criticized Hamas for the position it took, for the choosing possibly the wrong side in the war back then, we see now the Palestinian Islamic Resistance, Hamas, apparently deciding to restore ties with the government in Damascus. Why now? What prompted this new strategy by Hamas towards Damascus?
No doubt that the axis of resistance, with all of its diversity, stood beside Syria in the face of the global war against it. However, there were some factions that chose to go against what the axis of resistance represented. One of the most important factions that did so was the Islamic Resistance Movement, Hamas. That is why there was a rupture between Hamas and Syria all throughout the global war against Syria. Now, there exist new local, regional, and international variables. Turkey and Qatar, who welcomed Hamas after it cut ties with Damascus, now linger towards mending ties with the Syrian government. Add to that, there were mediations that never ceased throughout the past 10 years between Hamas and Damascus, with its most prominent sponsors being the Islamic Republic of Iran and the Lebanese resistance Hezbollah, along efforts from the Islamic Jihad and the general command of the Palestinian Popular Front. Hamas came to discover that what Damascus had presented to it before the war on Syria, no other country, be it Turkey or Qatar or Malaysia or any other Arab or Islamic country, was able to present. Hence, the freedom of movement and jihadi activism that Hamas enjoyed in Damascus was never given to Hamas in any other country. Therefore, Hamas found itself somewhat isolated inside the axis of resistance due to this rupture between Damascus. Add to that, the countries that welcomed Hamas over the past 10 years were not ready to accept Hamas as an armed resistance movement, rather were ready to only play the role of mediators between Hamas and Israel in the event of a war or to discuss the issue of Palestinian political detainees. However, these countries never allowed Hamas to have free movement and activism within the borders of their states. Hamas hence was pushed to revise its stances and positions. Hamas believes that the decision it made to mend ties with Syria is a purely rational decision rather than a popular decision. and that is because its popular base that followed the ideology of the Muslim Brotherhood still have a hostile position towards Syria. Hamas currently is trying to change this hostile position within its popular base by reconnecting with the Syrian state.
Well, Mr. Saleh, under the auspices of Hezbollah Secretary General Sayyid Hassan Nasrallah, the stalemate between Hamas and Syria was broken as a first step, and now they're working on a confidence building between the two parties, maybe in preparation for restoring a larger, broader relationship between both sides. How do you think this will affect the regional axis of resistance?
As we mentioned, Sayyid Hassan Nasrallah and Hezbollah had a pivotal role in breaking the chasm between Hamas and Syria. The main role goes back to Hezbollah, as we remember from Sayyid Nasrallah's speeches on several occasions mentioning this mediating role for Hezbollah. Hamas, over the past couple of years, issued several statements condemning the Zionist attacks on Syria. We can feel an improvement in the speech of Hamas leadership towards Damascus. It's clear that this leadership is working hard to prepare the popular conditions towards normalization with Syria. However, in return, Damascus doors are always open for the axis of resistance. The states and factions of the axis of resistance believe that Syria is the base column for the entire region in defending the Palestinian cause and in safeguarding the unity of the axis of resistance, which as a result all comes down to hostility against Israel. The return of Hamas to the main square of the axis of resistance entirely and its openness to all factions of the axis of resistance ultimately serves the Palestinian cause and serves the entire region, because more coordination will result from this openness. This is possible because Hamas and the Islamic Jihad are the biggest Palestinian resistance factions operating inside Palestine. Hence, reconnecting relations between Hamas and Damascus is crucial, especially that the relations between the Islamic Jihad and Damascus remain steadfast and continuous throughout the 10 years of global war on Syria. Amending these ties will strengthen the axis of resistance and will strengthen the partnership within this axis in order to attain effectiveness on all battlefields against the Zionist occupation.
However, do you think that Syria will be able to forgive easily what happened throughout the 10 past years?
I have no doubt that not only Damascus believed that Hamas chose the wrong side of this war, rather most of the factions in this axis of resistance believe so as well. However, I believe that Damascus will make sure that the interest of the resistance prevails before any other calculations. It will pick up its wounds and eventually forgive Hamas. It's true that the relations will not be complete between Syria and Hamas over the upcoming months or even few years. I believe it will take a lot of time to build trust between both sides. Syria has never betrayed the Palestinian cause and has never given up on the Palestinian resistance factions. Syria could have easily sold out on the Palestinian cause back in 2011 and could have chosen to drop all resistance factions in return for never having to suffer a war. Damascus was required to give up its relationship with the Palestinians, its relationship with Hezbollah, and its relationship with Iran so that Syria would remain a beacon in the region. But Syria preferred its principles and resistance to any war and paid the price for it. This tax was a tax of dignity and pride and a tax of preserving principles. In my opinion, because Syria is the caring father of the Arab region and because it will never abandon its historical role, I believe that it will overcome this ordeal. But it needs a lot of time to restore trust with Hamas. Therefore, the brothers in the Hamas movement should make more efforts to reconnect the relationship with Damascus and not be satisfied with official statements. These are issues that are required from Hamas in order for Damascus to reconsider trusting again the positions of Hamas. Damascus needs proof that Hamas's stance will not change in the near or far future based on any change in the positions of Turkey or Qatar or any other state for that matter.
Definitely. Well, at the end of the day, any news that comes about a positive dialogue between any parts of the regional resistance is very good news for the rest of the people in West Asia. I want to thank you very much, Mr. Saleh Abu Azzi, journalist and political commentator, for joining us from the West Bank to talk about this pressing issue. Now, please stay tuned, because next we will be talking about the fire that might be ignited between Lebanon and the Zionist entity.
This is Midstream, and here is IRIB English Radio. Dear listeners, in this weekly program, Marvo Osman discusses two important issues related to West Asia region with two political analysts. Midstream is with you every Friday on IRIB English Radio.
Hezbollah will not retreat from the timing it set to obtain the Israeli response, which must be translated into clear measures, nor will it retreat from implementing the Quraysh equation and beyond Quraysh equation if Israel tries to bypass it. In Israeli circles, the possibility of a war between Tel Aviv and Lebanon prevails. And the reason, according to those circles, is that Israel has no interest in yielding to Hezbollah's threats in the matter of the maritime dispute with Lebanon and conceding to Beirut in this file, because the consequences of this depend on the political status and the position of Israel, which may exceed the consequences of the confrontation, no matter how fierce the latter, and it will certainly be so if it breaks out. Confrontation between Israel and Hezbollah nears in this following report.
Although the ongoing negotiations between Lebanon and the Israeli entity have not ended yet, and no agreement has been reached regarding the demarcation of the maritime borders in the disputed area, the Israeli Ministry of Energy announced last week the start of preparations to connect the Karish field to the Israeli pipeline network for extraction and production of gas. It is worth noting that the Israeli Ministry of Energy's announcement contradicts the statement issued a week earlier by Energene Company, which in turn has announced the postponement of gas extraction from the Karish field for several weeks, without specifying the reasons behind the delay. Inside the Israeli entity, the possibility of a war between Tel Aviv and Lebanon prevails over the media and the political commentators. For Israel, complying today and giving Hezbollah approval to implement its demands as it wanted does not exclude war or confrontation with it. On the contrary, acquiescing to Hezbollah today raises the resistance morale even further. This high morale position will grant Hezbollah further advanced incentives towards confronting the Israeli entity. Hezbollah is basically always involved in a wide-ranging conflict with the entity, an open conflict that is not linked exclusively to maritime demarcation. The issue of Israel's occupation of Palestine and its usurpation of Arab and Islamic lands and holy sites, and its presence in the region as a usurping entity, are essential elements of Hezbollah's ideology, and confronting it is an existential issue that requires struggle, work, and fighting to end this cancerous state of occupation and oppression. As for Hezbollah, it is steadfast in confronting the entity in every sense of the word, as it has clearly defined what it wants from this round of the maritime demarcation, setting rules of engagement in an equation based on Karish and beyond Karish. On the other hand, Hezbollah considers that ending the maritime demarcation file with Israel, as per the conditions set by the Lebanese state, constitutes a major element of the confrontation with Israel. Because in practice, Hezbollah views that the siege maneuver and the economic pressures on Lebanon are but one element of the many elements of war against Lebanon. As such, Hezbollah depicts high importance to the maritime demarcation file as a complex confrontation from several aspects: economic, moral, political, and military, where the first three aspects are closely related to the military aspect through the rule of engagement imposed by the Quraysh equation. Accordingly, we find that Hezbollah is committed to what the Lebanese state decides through the team indirectly negotiating with the Israeli entity and under the auspices of Washington through its envoy Amos Hochstein. We also find it fully committed in the media and politically to the lines it had set in the Quraysh equation, without being affected by the confusion, criticism, or incitement that is being raised in Israel about this file.
To discuss this issue with us from Beirut is retired Lebanese Army General Mr. Elias Farhat. Thank you very much for being with us, General Elias. Now, Hezbollah Secretary General Sayyid Hassan Nasrallah said in a televised speech a couple of days back, he said, our eyes and missiles are fixated on the Quraysh field in the disputed maritime border area, adding, we are monitoring the course of negotiations to demarcate the maritime borders between Lebanon and the Israeli entity. In your opinion, when will Hezbollah's zero hour be to announce confrontation with the enemy?
Yes, Secretary General of Hezbollah, Sayyid Hassan Nasrallah, made it clear that Lebanon and Hezbollah will not allow Israel to extract oil and gas from Quraysh oil field, which is disputed between Lebanon and Israel. Before a final settlement to the demarcation points to the exclusive economic zone between Lebanon and Israel, which the American mediator Amos Hochstein is working on it. He said that Hezbollah calmed down recently. That does not mean that he will stand still if Israel started to extract the oil and the gas. He said our eyes and missiles are pointed at Quraysh gas field, and he is serious, and the Israelis are aware of that.
Well, General Farhat, although the American mediator Amos Hochstein is coming to Lebanon to convey, maybe in the upcoming days, a final proposal regarding the demarcation of the maritime borders, the Israeli occupation decided a few days ago that the implementation of the next phase of the exploitation of the Quraysh field is on its way. Do you think this is a bluff from Israel, or you think that Israel might actually have the firepower to end any kind of confrontation between Lebanon and Tel Aviv?
Yes, before entering the studio, President Aoun issued a press release that he received the United Nations representative in Lebanon, and he expressed his confidence that a final agreement on the delineation between the maritime exclusive economic zone between Lebanon and Israel will take place very soon. And the American mediator, Hochstein, is on full communication with the Lebanese authorities, and he is putting the final finalizing this agreement, which is supposed to be presented in the coming days. That means President Aoun is confident that all the rights of Lebanon in its exclusive economic zone, which means the blocks 8, 9, and 10, and some of the Quraysh disputed, that will be preserved to Lebanon, and we'll see big companies such as Total, the French, or Eni, the Italian, are digging, drilling in the Lebanese off coast exclusive economic zone.
But let's say, just for the analysis of it, that the agreement doesn't pass, or there's something that the Lebanese government does not like in the proposal coming from the Zionist entity. Do you think that Israel would have the firepower to end any confrontation against the resistance?
Yes, Israel leaked some news that they want to connect a tube to the FPSO, which is now near Quraysh. FPSO means floating product storage and offloading. This means that they want to extract before any agreement, which Hezbollah will not accept at all, and will have a response from Hezbollah. Likely will be a military response. This made the Israeli change their mind as they postponed the extraction from the beginning of September, they will postpone it until we reach an agreement about the exclusive economic zone delineation.
Well, Hezbollah made it clear, Mr. Farhad, that it will not retreat in terms of the timing it has set to obtain a clear Israeli response. However, do you think the Lebanese official stand in the event of a confrontation, let's say a war actually happens, do you think that Hezbollah's back is protected in Lebanon?
Yes, I know that there is a deep coordination between the political leadership represented by General Michel Aoun, President Aoun, and the Hezbollah. There is continuous coordination on every step in the negotiations and all the communications with the American envoy, and things are in the right direction.
But in the event of a war, do you think that Hezbollah will have a challenge in Lebanon? Will the back of Hezbollah be protected?
I don't think so. Hezbollah warned Israel that any extraction in any way will not be accepted by Hezbollah, and the resistance will have a response. And this is a final decision.
But the thing that actually most of the public are concerned about in Lebanon, that if Hezbollah actually goes to war, someone inside Lebanon might attack Hezbollah. Do you think that's possible?
I don't think so. That in this case, Israel is the aggressive, and not Lebanon. You mm-hmm. see, Lebanon is in the defensive, and Israel is in the offensive. So we cannot leave Israel extract our oil and gas from the bottoms of our exclusive economic zone. This is a national stand for all the Lebanese and. Mainly for the political leadership represented by the President of the Republic.
Mm-hmm. Well, before we end off, I want to ask you, as a former army general in the Lebanese army, Mr. Farhat, do you think that in the event that Israel becomes an aggressor on Lebanon, that the role of the Lebanese army will be clear alongside the resistance, the same way we saw in Arsal, maybe, or maybe the Lebanese army here will sit aside?
Yes, the Lebanese army is deployed along the borders between Lebanon and Israel with the UNIFIL, and parts where the UNIFIL is not deployed is deployed alone, and he received orders from the Council of Ministers to respond and confront any Israeli aggression and will not stand still. The Lebanese army will defend all the Lebanese soil.
Mm-hmm. Well, I want to thank you very much, retired Lebanese Army General Elias Farhad, for being with us to discuss this pressing issue in Lebanon, which is taking a lot of the headlines here in Beirut. I want to thank you for your cooperation, and thank you, ladies and gents. I hope that you enjoy what we bring you here on top news from the ground here in the West Asian part of the region. And please stay tuned next week for more news from the Middle East stream. See you again soon.
Fiqh or jurisprudence is an Islamic knowledge and is ranked
the Holy Prophet of Islam is the example
of
self-purification is the most significant
factor.
Imamat is a living principle in the history of Islam and Shiism.
This is
Ulama Speech, the best selection of the speeches of prominent Shia scholars.
In the name of Allah, the Beneficent, the Merciful, welcome to another episode of the program Ulama's Speech on IRIB English Radio Call of Islam page. In this episode, we invite you to listen to the English translation of a short Farsi speech by Ayatollah Javadi Amali. Please stay tuned.
وقتی اون سائل از کد قل الزجیج و کسر الحجیج حاجی ها زیادن.
One good example about the special power of the infallibles is when Imam al-Baqir alayhi salam or Imam al-Sajjad were present at Hajj pilgrimage. Over there, in the ceremony of Hajj, a person stated, "There are so many pilgrims here, but the voice is low." Imam, based on his divine knowledge, stated, "There are a few real pilgrims, and much is the noise." Experiences like this are based on divine knowledge of the infallibles who can see the reality of the things. If a person stands against the Imam of his age, he will like the pilgrims who are at the house of Allah, but are only making noise, and his worshipping is not true. Therefore, an Imam like Prophet and Allah have special powers. He can see the realities of the universe. Also, he is able to show to the people around him some of his powers. So an Imam have knowledge without formal learning. He is able to act based on his will, and he has special miracle-like powers. Thank you very much, dear listeners, for listening to this episode of the program Ulama's Speech, which was the English translation of a short Farsi speech by Ayatollah Javadi Amali. To find out more about this program, log on to our website, parstoday.com/en/call of Islam page. We leave you in Allah's care and goodbye.
If you're interested to know about history, culture, family, politics, religion, art, etc., you wouldn't want to miss the chance to tune into the IRIB English Radio. please log on to our website www.parstoday.com/en.
In the limelight.
In protest to the ongoing Zionist regime crimes in occupied Palestine, Chilean President Gabriel Boric denied the credentials of Israeli Ambassador Gil Artzieli. In this regard, we have taken a look at the world media for further details. Stay tuned for more. Crescent International wrote, Chilean president sets moral standard by refusing to accept Israeli ambassador's credentials over killings of Palestinians. President Gabriel Boric of Chile refused to receive the credentials of the Zionist regime's new ambassador Gil Artzieli to his country. The Zionist entity's ambassador was summoned to the Chilean presidential palace to present his credentials on September 15th as per protocol. The young Chilean president, 36, however, refused to receive him. The reason? Because of Israel killing children in the recent escalation in the West Bank and increased Israeli military activity against Palestinians, according to the Chilean newspaper Ex Ante. President Boric is a supporter of Palestine and has not minced words about Israeli regime atrocities against innocent Palestinians. In response to a question from Ex-Ante, the Chilean Ministry of Foreign Affairs said, the persecution of Israel's credentials has been rescheduled to the second week of October because today is a very sensitive day due to the killing of a boy in the West Bank. The Palestinian community in Chile applauded President Boric's decision to not receive the credentials of the Zionist regime's envoy. The Palestinian Community President, Maurice Khamis Massou, said in a statement, the Palestinian community of Chile highly values the decision of President Gabriel Boric Fund to postpone the ceremony of the diplomatic credentials of the new Israeli ambassador to Chile because the Israeli occupation army assassinated the minor Odi Salah from Kafardan in Jenin, occupied Palestinian territory. Massou also thanked the president for his continued support for Palestine. We firmly believe that as long as the world continues to treat Israel and its diplomats as normal, the situation of Palestinians won't improve. Israel systematically commits war crimes, crimes against humanity, human rights violations, and subjects the Palestinian population to an apartheid regime. Despite a blanket of silence thrown over Israeli regime crimes by Western regimes, the rest of the world is gradually waking up to Zionist atrocities. Amnesty International, Human Rights Watch, the UN High Commissioner for Human Rights, and even Israeli human rights organizations like B'Tselem have documented and highlighted the Zionist regime's crimes. On May 27, 2021, the Office of UN Human Rights Council held a special session on the grave human rights situation in the occupied Palestinian territory, including East Al-Quds, and adopted the resolution ensuring respect for international human rights law and international humanitarian law in the occupied Palestinian territory, including East Al-Quds. Through its resolution, the Human Rights Council decided to urgently establish an ongoing independent international commission of inquiry to investigate in the occupied Palestinian territory, including East Al-Quds and in the occupied territories, all violations of international humanitarian law and abuses of international human rights law leading up and since April 13, 2021. The resolution further requested the Commission of Inquiry to investigate all underlying root causes of recurrent tensions, instability and protraction of conflict, including systematic discrimination and repression based on national, ethnic, racial, or religious identity. The Commission of Inquiry was mandated to report to the Human Rights Council and to the General Assembly on an annual basis as from June 2022 and September 2022, respectively. In light of these reports, the Chilean president's bold action has once again put a spotlight on the Zionist regime crimes. If the Arabian rulers that are falling over each other to normalize relations with the pariah regime in Tel Aviv had any self-respect or dignity, they would learn from the young Chilean president's example. Middle East Eye also wrote, Chile's President Gabriel Boric refused to accept the credentials of Gil Arzieli, the new Israeli ambassador to the country, after being angered by the Zionist regime's military killing of a 17-year-old Palestinian overnight. Government sources told the Chilean news site Ex Ante that Boric 36 decided not to see the ambassador because today is a very sensitive day due to the death of a minor in the Gaza Strip. The teenager, Oday Saleh, was in fact killed in the occupied West Bank after being shot in the head by Israeli regime forces. The Chile-Palestine community group thanked Boric for his decision in a statement saying it values enormously the decision of the President of the Republic to postpone the reception for the credentials of the new Israeli ambassador in Chile because on the same day, the Zionist regime occupation army assassinated a minor in Kafr Dan Jenin. It added that the president's gesture should be an example for the world to follow in response to Israeli regime war crimes and the killing of children. Boric, a left-wing leader who has been sharply critical of the fake regime of Israel and also supports boycotts against goods from Israeli settlements in the occupied Palestine, was elected president last year in a landslide victory.
Ask the followers of the remembrance if ye know not.
You're listening to the program The Key on IRIB English Radio with Shiraz Hossein Agha, a graduate of Islamic Seminary of Rome and a PhD in philosophy.
Bismillahir Rahmanir Rahim. Welcome to our program, The Key, here at IRIB English Radio. Today on The Key, we would like to offer our condolences to our esteemed listeners on the demise of the Holy Prophet Muhammad, sallallahu alayhi wa alihi wa sallam, as well as the martyrdom and demise of his grandson, Imam Hassan alayhi salam. Today on The Key, we would like to pose a question, and that question is regarding the event, the sad and solemn event that occurred today, which is the demise of the Holy Prophet. The question is, why is it that this is such a grave and solemn and momentous event? Why is it that this event is so sad for us? The answer to this question can be sought out in the various ahadith that we have regarding the demise of the Prophet. For example, in his famous sermon speech that Imam Ali alayhi salam gave at the time of the demise of the Holy Prophet, Imam Ali alayhi salam kind of alludes to why the death of the Prophet was such a great and significant event. The Imam says, "Bi'abi anta wa ummi ya Rasulullah, may the life of my father and mother be sacrificed for you, O Prophet of God. لَقَدْ انْقَتَعَ بِمَوْتِكَ مَا لَمْ يَنْقَتِ بِمَوْتِ غَيْرِكَ." Something was discontinued, something was cut off by means of your death, which had not been disconnected or cut off by means of the death of anyone besides you. Meaning with the death of the Prophet, something was cut off, something was discontinued, something was finished that had not been finished by the death of anyone before the Prophet nor after him. What is that? Min al-nubuwwat wal-anba'i wa akhbar al-sama. Revelation, the Quran and revelation, as well as knowledge of the unseen and the events that would occur in the future. These are all things that were cut off with the demise of the Holy Prophet. And we know that the Quran and revelation, this is one of the greatest blessings that God has given all of humanity. And in order to reinforce this, in continuation, the Imam says, خَصَّصْتَ حَتَّى سِرْتَ مُسَلِّيًا أَمَّنْ سِوَاكَ. He says that your death was so special, was so significant, that in comparison to it, the death of everyone else became easy, and it became a source of consolation for the death of everyone else besides you. And then the Imam said, وَعَمَمْتَ حَتَّى صَارَ النَّاسُ فِيكَ سَوَى. Your death was a sad and solemn event for everyone, to the extent that everybody was mourning your death. Thank you for joining us here on The Key. We were looking at the significance of the demise of the Holy Prophet and why is it so important. Inshallah, until next time, wassalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh.
That was Shiraz Hussein Agha, a graduate of Islamic Seminary of Qom and a PhD in philosophy, on the program The Key on IRIB English Radio.
You can also send your questions to English Radio at irib.ir.
This is the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran broadcasting. The voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran is broadcast daily from 1520 to 1620 UTC on the following frequencies. Shortwave 25 meters, 11,865 kilohertz for the Indian subcontinent, and FM 91.5 megahertz for Tehran. You can also listen to the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran on Hotbird, Eutelsat 3B, and IranSat or Bat 5, and via the internet. Our internet address is parstoday.com/en. And now you can listen to IRIB English Radio via your mobile phone. Please refer to our website for the details. Thank you.
This is IRIB English Radio. Coming up is the news.